This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we devote the entire hour to a special program interviewing the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Chris Hedges. Hedges is not only a reporter, but really a moral philosopher, and has one of the most acute analyses in America of what's going on today.
Yes, Michael, we're devoting the full hour to Chris's analysis that looks at the Israeli-U.S. war against Iran, the demolition of Gaza, and the authoritarian direction of the country, and what is required to effectively resist.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
We are living in a time of great peril to humanity. Two nuclear-armed countries, the United States and Israel, commenced a war of aggression against Iran on February 28th. The war threatens to spread uncontrollably. It quickly became regional. A world war could be triggered with the danger that the United States or Israel would use their atomic bombs. Israel's got 300. The United States has got 5,000. The radioactive fallout would bring about a nuclear winter. The dust from the explosion would block sunlight, extinguishing life on Earth. Israel seeks to make Iran into a failed state to achieve what it wants, quote, a greater Israel. Getting the United States involved in a war against Iran has been the project of Benjamin Netanyahu for 30 years. American presidents and the American military resisted this, but not Trump. He declared, after ordering the assassination of Iran's leader, that, quote, I got him before he got me. There are 50,000 American soldiers in the area. 3,000 Marines are headed towards Iran. The 101st Airborne Division and the 82nd Airborne Division have been deployed. Their paratroopers will work just like they did in the illegal invasion of Iraq 23 years ago. At that time, President George Bush lied, falsely stating that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. The lie this time is that Iran would soon develop nuclear bombs and missiles capable of delivering them even as far as the USA. The current war of illegal aggression reminds us that on September 1, 1939, Hitler sent his troops east to invade Poland. 6 years later, the world war that resulted ended with the United States using atomic bombs for the first time ever on Japan. 60 million people died in World War II. We speak today with returning guest Chris Hedges. We'll discuss how the USA got into this situation and how it can get out of it. Hedges is a journalist, but he's more than that. He's a moral philosopher. Chris Hedges contributed the first chapter in the Law and Disorder book, From the Flag to the Cross, Fascism, American Style. He's the author of 14 books of his own, including a recent book on Gaza. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner and the former head of the New York Times Middle Eastern Bureau. Chris Hedges, a hearty, warm welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael.
Chris, international law experts say that the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran is illegal, as Iran was not threatening any imminent attacks on the U.S. or Israel. Do you agree with the experts say that they violated international law by starting their war with Iran, and in the case of Israel, with Lebanon as well?
Yes. Yes, exactly. I mean, Iran did not pose an existential threat to the United States, and this was something that the Pentagon has been telling successive administrations for four decades, because, of course, Israel has been lobbying for a war, along with the fact that it would be extremely difficult to, if they did attack Iran, subdue it. So, yes, it's a clear violation of international law. A preemptive war is considered a war crime.
Chris, Trump has been all over the map as to why we went to war against Iran, giving contradictory explanations, sometimes changing by the hour. Why do you believe the United States started its war against Iran? Did it have anything to do with Israel wanting to do so? Was it for other reasons? Talk to us about this.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, Israel, in particular, Bibi Netanyahu, has been lobbying for a war against Iran for 40 years with the same argument that they're about to develop a nuclear weapon. Of course, the irony is that the supreme leader who the Trump administration and Israel assassinated prohibited under religious law the development of a nuclear weapon. But the Trump administration, and I think we can't discount the influence of the Israeli assets, Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, got sold this idea that they would take out the supreme leader and, like Venezuela, the regime would crumble, fall to its knees, and it would be a quick victory. And that, of course, was a complete misreading of the Iranian power structure. And just, I should mention, I worked quite a bit in Iran, and Trump fell for it. He took the bait. But it's not our war. I mean, this is, and the object of the war is very different for the United States and for Israel. This is about Israel's vision of greater Israel, of dominating the Middle East. But they can't do that without our military or our taxpayer dollars or our weapons. And that's what we've handed them. So you see with the Israeli attacks, it's about infrastructure. It's about obliterating urban centers, industrial sites, because they want to turn Iran into a failed state. I'm not sure that's the U.S. goal. Failed states, as we have seen throughout the Middle East, spawn all sorts of rogue terrorist groups and militias, etc. But, you know, Israel's lackeys in the political class and their courtiers in the media have essentially led us once again into another fiasco in Iraq, in Iran, and it has happened in Iraq. It's not going to go well for the United States. It's not going well, and they're kind of flailing about. You saw that with Trump's address, which was just filled with all sorts of contradictions. We've devastated them. They want to negotiate. We're going to bomb them back to the Stone Age. I mean, with no clear strategy at all. There was never any real strategy. I mean, we're really in big trouble.
Chris, what do you believe are the chances that the U.S. and Israel will put troops on the ground in Iran?
I don't think Israel is going to put troops on the ground, but I think we are. I think that's imminent. We have already deployed a Tripoli amphibious ready group. That's the 31st Marine Expeditionary Unit. That's about 3,500 sailors and Marines, and they come accompanied by strike fighter aircraft, amphibious assault, tactical assets. We've deployed the Boxer amphibious ready group. That has about 2,500 Marines. They also have stealth fighters, Ospreys, etc., and then 2,000 paratroopers from the 1st Brigade Combat Team of the 82nd Airborne. And there are reports that these will all be augmented by an additional 10,000 troops. And I think it's pretty clear that what they would like to do is seize the islands, not just Karg Island. That's where 90% of Iran's oil exports go out from, but also these Persian Gulf islands of Abu Musa, the Greater and Lesser Tombs, Larak, and along with Karg, to try and control the Strait of Hormuz and open it up. I don't think it's going to work, but I think that's pretty. It certainly looks very likely that's what's next. I think it's going to be a disaster for reasons we can go into.
Chris, I'd like you to go into those reasons, frankly. You say you think it's going to be a disaster if we do indeed set the Navy and the Air Force and everybody else into war with Iran. Why do you think it will be a disaster? Don't we have such a superior military that it won't be?
Well, the Strait of Hormuz is so narrow that, for instance, the Abraham Lincoln carrier strike group just has to stay out of range of Iran in the Arabian Sea. I don't think it could move closer without tremendous risk to support an amphibious assault. My guess is that amphibious assault would be so risky given, and remember, the Iranians have been preparing this for decades, that probably you'll have air assaults that they would come in. They might take some of the smaller islands first. But what you've got then are essentially fixed positions. The Iranians can essentially, I mean, they can even use artillery, but they can use their anti-ship cruise missiles, their ballistic missiles, their underwater drones, their mines. I think there's no question that any assault like that would be pretty costly in terms of American troops. Then there's the whole resupply question, because these strike forces, I think they carry resupplies for up to about 15 days. How are they going to get resupplied? And they're just, the Iranians will just rain this stuff down upon them. I think it's extremely risky. And my guess is it is in the long term, it's not even going to work unless then you begin a full kind of ground invasion along the coast, because the Iranians have all sorts of firepower, and that coastline, people don't know, is very long. I mean, it's over 1,000 miles long. So it's just, it's a really dangerous operation. It's one of the reasons why the Pentagon never wanted to do it in the first place. And this was, whether that was Republican administrations or Democratic administrations, didn't make any difference. The Pentagon was just adamant about not doing it.
Chris, Brandon Carr, the head of the Federal Communications Commission, he's threatened the news media with the loss of their broadcast licenses because of what he claims is an anti-American bias in their news coverage of the war in Iran. He wants them to be more patriotic, et cetera, et cetera. Is he right? Is the coverage of the war biased against America and Israel?
Well, the deterioration of the coverage, I think, is evidenced by the fact that the media won't ask the fundamental questions about this war. Because, and I speak as an old newspaper reporter, 15 years with the New York Times, in order to ask the questions, you have to understand what's happening and be willing to make a judgment. So, for instance, why are we losing the war with Iran? Which we are. But that's a judgment they're not going to make because of blowback. And I think it's interesting. I did an interview with John Mearsheimer. I think it's got over 2 million views on YouTube, not because I'm particularly a great interviewer or anything, but because, although John's great, it's because I posed the question. Why did the Trump administration, or what did Israel do to entice the Trump administration to go to war with Iran? That's a question. Those are fundamental questions. And the mainstream media just won't ask them. And that's why you see people flocking to alternative media, because it has lost either the ability or the stomach to ask the hard questions and answer them. And if you don't ask the questions, you can't find the answers. The mainstream media has been in free fall for a long time. I find one of the most ludicrous attempts on the part of the Zionist lobby to fix the messaging problem is the seizure of, with Larry Ellison, of CBS and Barry Weiss, as if CBS wasn't obsequious enough, when, of course, Barry Weiss is just a human hand grenade and is going to destroy, is destroying what's left of CBS. And they'll do the same with CNN and TikTok when they get a hold of that. So that's a collapse of the traditional media, and which has always been obsequious to Israel and to the Israel lobby. And I would add to the war industry, all of the commentators on these networks, even on, MSNBC is now MN or something, I don't watch it, but are all retired intelligence officials and generals. But they just, in this climate, you either are completely sycophantic under the Trump administration or you're shut out.
I want to ask you about Israel and Lebanon. Israel's gone to war against Iran and Lebanon. And in the case of Lebanon, as they attack Hezbollah, they've made a military decision to destroy the bridges linking the North and South Lebanon. It would appear that they've got plans to occupy South Lebanon and make it, like Gaza, a part of Greater Israel. Or am I reading too much into this, Chris? Is Israel's military move so far? Can you talk about that?
No, that's the plan. They're quite open about it. They're going to do to southern Lebanon what they have already done to Gaza, which is obliterate it and turn it into what they call a buffer zone, but which is essentially an expansion of Israeli territory. Remember, they've already expanded past the Golan Heights, which they seized in the 1967 war. They pushed almost up to Damascus. they are, as we speak, there's a kind of de facto annexation of the West Bank, propelled by these rogue colonist militias armed with automatic weapons that are carrying out reigns of terror against the Palestinians. And what they would like to do is turn Iran into the failed state that Syria is, that Libya is, and that Iraq is. Iraq is fragmented. It's not a unified state anymore. And that is exactly the project of greater Israel. So you either control it directly, as the Israeli military is doing in Gaza, in the West Bank, in southern Lebanon, in parts of Syria, or you control it through proxies. That's one of the reasons the Israeli government is pushing the return of the Shah's son. He doesn't have any, I can tell you, as someone who spent a lot of time in Iran, he has zero popular appeal within Iran. He does within kind of the exile community, but not within Iran itself. And so, yes, this is part of the greater Israel project, without question.
I wonder, Chris, it's no secret that Christian nationalism has grown stronger in America over the years. Indeed, you've written a book about it. Remind our listeners what Christian nationalism is, the role it plays in the country in general, and in the Trump administration in particular.
Right. So Christian nationalism is the sacralization, in essence, of imperialism, of capitalism, and of white supremacy. Now, I speak as a graduate of Harvard Divinity School. It is, to my mind, heretical. It comes out of the prosperity gospel, the idea that those who are wealthy, those who have success, have achieved that wealth or that success because they are blessed and anointed by God. It is the bifurcation of the world into good and evil, us and them, Muslims, in their view, in the view of Christian nationalists, are satanic. They worship a satanic religion. You can see Hegseth picking up on this kind of rhetoric. I look at them as heretics. And I said so. I wrote a book it must be 15 years ago, called American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War in America, calling them out not as a religious group, but as a political group. And Trump, who has no real ideology of his own other than, you know, this narcissism and attempt to, well, not a quite successful attempt to enrich himself and his family. And I think Bernie Sanders used a figure of $4 billion since Trump took office going to his family through various business interests that they've set up. But that ideological void is filled by the Christian right. And Vance comes out of it, Hegseth comes out of it, and these people are really Christian fascists. I didn't use that word lightly. They carry all of the, I would say, fundamental tenets of fascism. Fascism, when it comes to a country, always dresses itself in the comforting symbols and iconography and language of the historical past. That's why German fascism was very different from Italian fascism. The Italian fascism under Mussolini looked back to the age of Augustus and Imperial Rome and the Roman Empire and that kind of stuff. German fascism was built around the Nordic myth. And as in that great book, Anatomy of Fascism by Paxton, he talks about fascism coming to America with mass recitations of the Pledge of Allegiance and the Christian cross. But that movement is dominant now. It is quite powerful. Betsy DeVos comes out of this. I mean, all these figures come out of it. So, and of course, her brother, who founded Blackwater, is, you know, builds these mercenary forces. It's a dangerous and a powerful movement, and one that has found free rein within the Trump administration.
Chris, Christian nationalism has grown within the U.S. military as well as within civilian life, has it not? Isn't Secretary of Defense, or as he calls himself, Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, a Christian nationalist? Talk to us about him and this growth.
Yes, it has grown, and not in terms of percentages, but I had read a breakdown. It was very interesting in terms of combat units, people who identify as Christian nationalists and white are a preponderant majority. So you have a fairly significant percentage of people of color within the military, but they tend not to be within the combat units. And Hegseth, of course, comes out of this Christian nationalism. He is tied with a very fundamentalist and, you know, frightening kind of religious movement. He has held these blood-curdling prayer services in the Pentagon. I mean, he's not alone, but he's one of the public faces of the Trump administration that embodies what I would call this Christian fascism. If you're a one-star general or something and you want to get a promotion and you happen to be a woman or a person of color, it doesn't happen. Or if you're in a position of authority, you get dismissed. I mean, the racism and the celebration of white supremacy and the denigration of other ethnicities and cultures and religions, it's not even hidden. There's nothing subtle about it.
Well, Chris, in one of your recent online articles, you state that, and I quote, "Trump is dangerous not simply because of his imbecility and unbridled narcissism, but because he lacks the core attributes of empathy and understanding that define the human soul," close quote. You've said, in fact, that in the moral sense, Trump simply has no soul. Explain this claim.
Yeah, I mean, he has he exhibits all of the fundamental traits of psychopaths, really. The lack of empathy and remorse, shame, and of course all of this was exhibited, interestingly, in the release of the Epstein files, among our ruling class of billionaires and Wall Street financiers and philanthropists and celebrities and university presidents like Larry Summers and everyone else. But yeah, he has all of those qualities that I think out of a religious tradition we would consider necessary for a soul. And that eschews the sense of or a desire to see justice, for the capacity for self-sacrifice, for humility, for introspection. I mean, all of those attributes that are required for the capacity of reverence. And I mean, I think it's also interesting that the soulless have no sense of aesthetics. There's no sense of balance, of symmetry, of proportion. It's just the bigger, the gaudier, the more encrusted in gold leaf, the better. And you see that in, you know, the monuments that Trump is building to himself, whether it's the tearing down the East Wing and this gaudy, oversized $400 million ballroom, his proposed memorial arch, which is, again, like the Oval Office, filled with gilded statues and eagles in honor of himself, if it's built, I guess it's going to be built, it will be bigger than the Arc of Triumph erected by the North Korean dictator, his National Garden of American Heroes. And then we already see his face on banners on the sides of federal buildings in renaming the John F. Kennedy Memorial Center for Performing Arts to after himself, the Donald J. Trump and John F. Kennedy, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So he's even named a new class of battleships after himself. So that is characteristic of people who there's something dead inside of them, this insatiable self-worship. This constant need to erect idols to yourself. But what it also comes with it is a never-ending stream of victims. It comes with this demand for complete subservience, when you can see it at every cabinet meeting. I mean, those are the traits of psychopathic individuals, but in religious terms, we call them people without souls. And that's what Dostoevsky in The Brothers Karamazov said, that the hell is the inability to love. That's really the plight of the soulless. And I think they kind of seek in their misery to make their own personal hell our own hell.
Pete Hegseth has got a huge Crusader cross tattooed on his chest. And he's also got the slogan, Deus Vult, which I understand was the slogan of the Crusaders who went from Europe across over to the Middle East under the banner of Deus Vult. What does that mean? Why does Pete Hegseth see himself as a Crusader?
Yeah, I mean, this is a complete misreading, historical misreading of what the Crusades were, which was about theft and looting and mass murder. But they did, at least for a time, manage to occupy much of the coastline down through Lebanon, what's modern-day Lebanon, all the way to Jerusalem. And they did so under the banner of the Christian cross. It was blessed by the Pope. And I think that it is emblematic of not just the mindset of Hegseth, but the mindset of these Christian fascists who essentially embrace righteous, what they would call righteous violence, the extermination of those deemed to embody evil. Remember, all fundamentalists externalize evil. Evil is not something that I was taught, that that we all have the capacity for evil, and you struggle within yourself to recognize that evil and prevent it. These people see evil embodied in other human beings, who once those human beings are annihilated, then you can enter a world in which evil doesn't exist. And I think that is the attraction of the Crusades and the attraction of this Manichaean view of the world, where Muslims and Islam are considered satanic. They're considered forces of evil that must be eradicated to create a world without evil.
That's ironic, isn't it? Because Muslims look upon themselves as their religion is kind of an extension of the Jewish religion and the Christian religion. I mean, they've got the same saints. So it really is unbelievable, the ignorance that they show. But I wanted to ask you, Chris, about international law. The system of international law and the United Nations was built after World War II to prevent the World War III. Has all of this been destroyed by what's been going on lately?
Yes, I think we're at a very frightening kind of seminal moment in post-World War II history. And I think, as you correctly point out, starting with the genocide in Gaza, it's been very clear that international law, the UN Charter, the Genocide Convention, all of it doesn't have any sway anymore. Not only have the United States and its allies refused to intervene to stop the genocide as demanded by international law, but they have sustained it. And so we've entered a world, and this is not lost on the global South, where genocide is an acceptable tool by which powerful Western industrial states can exert their will. I think what's happened in Gaza is a message. And that message has just turned us into a pariah. As I mentioned before, Israel talks about Gaza being the model for what's happening in southern Lebanon. And the moment that the UN Security Council embraced the so-called Trump peace plan, which is a sham. I mean, it's just a joke, a complete violation of the recognition of Palestinian sovereignty and rights, that was kind of the end. So, yes, we've entered a kind of Hobbesian universe where the strong do whatever they want and rules and laws only apply to the weak. We're seeing it as we speak in Iran, although Iran is, by fighting asymmetrical warfare, creating tremendous problems for Israel and the United States. But it's a very dark moment in human history. And of course, those ideals of honoring international humanitarian law were always utopian. We didn't hardly honor them in Vietnam and with the invasion of Iraq, etc. But at least they were held up as an ideal. Now they've just been completely cast aside.
You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host Michael Smith, and we're interviewing the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges. Chris, domestically, the constitutional order established back in 1789 has been clearly whittled away at, hasn't it? The system of checks and balances has been mostly destroyed. What was that system, and how would you describe what we now have in its place?
Well, the system was meant to fracture power so that it wasn't concentrated in the hands of an all-powerful executive. And just as an aside, what's interesting is that after the 1979 revolution that brought to power Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, is that they also created a system where power was divided so that they couldn't, there would not be another Shah. And so, for instance, the Congress, it's the Congress who declares war, but Trump has started a war with Iran. He didn't even consult Congress. Now, this began, this decay in the American political system began before Trump. The executive orders, the ability of the executive branch to, in essence, declare war without consulting Congress, all of this predated Trump, but Trump has just carried it to its logical conclusion. But what we are getting, of course, is now the kind of classic machinery that one sees in any dictatorship. Part of it is the contempt for the open contempt for the rule of law. You had in Minneapolis, I think there were 96 court orders, all of which the Trump administration ignored. The Department of Justice is being transformed into a vengeance machine against Trump enemies, Trump opponents. And apparently, according to the New York Times, it's not enough of a vengeance machine, and he may replace Pam Bondi with someone else. So we are rapidly watching the consolidation of an American dictatorship. But, fascism, authoritarian states are always bred by a bankrupt liberalism. So none of this began with Trump. This has been in, and it's been the focus of all of my books for the last few decades, not just American Fascists, the Christian Right, and the War in America, but The Death of the Liberal Class, Empire of Illusion, The End of Literacy, and The Triumph of Spectacle, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, America, The Farewell Tour. I kept, like a few, there were other writers too who did it. We kept ringing the alarm bells that there are really serious consequences for the corrosion of American democracy, the ability of the billionaire class and corporations and the oligarchs to reconfigure the American system to serve their own interests of financial accumulation and power. And so Trump is really he's not the disease. Trump's the symptom. Trump's what you get. That's what systems like this eventually vomit up.
Let's talk a moment about the disintegration of American liberalism. And I'm talking about the Democratic Party. Chris, the Democratic Party is what Sheldon Wolin, the great political scientist, called the inauthentic opposition. Why do you think he called it that?
Yes, well, I am a great fan of Sheldon Wolin, as you know, the political philosopher. And he wrote a book at the end of his life called Democracy Incorporated. He understood, especially with Citizens United and the infusion of dark money into the political system, that it was a faux opposition. On all of the major issues, war, the defense budget, austerity measures, deindustrialization, wholesale surveillance, which Edward Snowden courageously exposed to all of us, the Democrats. I mean, the Democrats had the Epstein files under Biden for 4 years. They didn't release them because, of course, the Democrats, like the Republicans, like all of our power elite, are in this degenerate cabal that Epstein represents. On cultural issues, there are differences. but on the substantial issues of domestic control, including, of course, the massive expansion of the prison system that was begun under Clinton, the militarization of police begun under Clinton, with heavy lobbying by Joe Biden, who was in the Senate at the time. So, and I think Democracy Incorporated by Sheldon Wolin was very prescient in that it essentially exposed the hollowness of our own democratic system. And it was interesting that, so he uses the term inverted totalitarianism, and by that mean it's, in Wolin's idea, wasn't classical totalitarianism. It doesn't revolve around a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but was the ascendancy of corporate power. So you could elect people to Congress, or people would get appointed to judges, but internally, corporations and the billionaire class held all of the levers of power. And I remember asking Wolin, I did the last interview with him before he died, which is on YouTube and is worth, it's a 3-hour interview and worth watching, if, and he cited the ability to get cheap credit and consumer products as a kind of pacifying agent. And I said to him, well, if that credit dries up, if cheap consumer goods are no longer cheap, then without that pacifying agent, do you get the rise of a demagogue? And he conceded that that was then perhaps the next stage. And that's, of course, where we are.
Well, yes, indeed. And Trump himself, though, has done the opposite of what he promised to do when he ran for president. Why did people vote for him, do you believe? And why does his approval rating still hover somewhere between 33% and 35% or 36%? Are these people, the folks who voted for Trump and still find the answering they approve of him, are they reachable? And how can we do that?
I think that you have to look at those people who support Trump as members of a cult. And I think that when you see Trump as a cult leader, and all demagogues are cult leaders, then the traditional rules of politics don't apply. And when you disempower, disenfranchise huge segments of your population, when you take away any prospect of hope or advancement, you engender, I would argue, a legitimate kind of rage. And cult leaders use the usually very crude language, as Trump does, in their promises to crush the forces that are embodied in demonized groups and individuals that are blamed for the disenfranchisement and the misery. That's what all demagogues and cult leaders have done. That's what Trump does. The more the cult leader flouts law and social conventions to at least their cultish base, the more popular they become, because you want your cult leader to be immune to the norms of established society. That's part of their appeal. And you want them to have a godlike power. And the people who grant their cult leader this power believe that by making that cult leader omnipotent, they will be saved. And that's what Trump has done to the carcass that was the Republican Party. Remember, the establishment Republican figures, all Liz Cheney, all these figures, Mitt Romney, they all became honorary members of the Democratic Party. Kamala Harris actually was thrilled that Dick Cheney, who was a war criminal, supported her when she ran her issueless, celebrity-driven, tone-deaf campaign. So Trump tapped into this yearning for a cult leader and has played it quite successfully. So people who are in cults, reality does not tend to impinge on their own judgment and what they see, because they've already been ushered into a non-reality-based universe. And it's interesting that this is typical of megachurch leaders who also prey on the despair, I learned this when I wrote my book, of their congregants, and they've become like Trump, like Trump's sham university and everything else. They've become incredibly wealthy, flying around in private jets, and because people are desperate to be saved. And that's why I always look at the Democratic Party's betrayal of the working class as really the trigger that brought us to where we are. So that's why, 70% of the people who identify as Republicans still support this utter fiasco in Iran. It's because, well, they're, of course, indoctrinated through Fox News and Breitbart and all these other places. But at its core, it's really because they've severed themselves from reality, and they become susceptible to manipulation, to lies, to conspiracy theories, and you know, attempting to counter this absurdism with rational argument, unfortunately, doesn't work. And I think even to a certain extent, you would have to say Trump doesn't take his own statement seriously. I mean, he has the capacity to deny even making them, even though there's a, you know, physical evidence that he did, that they're documented. Because in this world, lies and truth don't matter. The language of the cult leader geared towards appealing to the emotional needs of those in the cult, and that's what those in the cult want. They want their emotional needs appealed to. Unfortunately, that is symptomatic of a deeply diseased society, which we have become.
Well, this brings us up to the point where we are now, Chris. How would you evaluate the outpouring of millions of people in thousands of places on No King's Day on March 28th? How do you evaluate that?
Well, on the one hand, it's better than sitting at home. On the other hand, it's not going to be effective until we disrupt the machinery of commerce and government, which comes through strike primarily, or occupation. You had Just Stop Oil, for instance, shutting down the M25 motorway in London, and you can always tell when the ruling class feels threatened because of how they respond. So Roger Hallam, who co-founder of Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil, even though he wasn't on the motorway, but he did help organize it, he got a 5-year prison sentence. But we're going to have to begin to embrace the militant tactics, which are in our history, going back to the Wobblies and the Communist Party. We've kind of erased the Communist Party from American history. But those radical movements, Mother Jones, Eugene V. Debs, all of these figures who understood the danger of unfettered, unregulated capitalism and fought back against it. We had the bloodiest labor wars of any industrialized country. Hundreds of American workers were killed, courtesy of the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and everyone else. And these capitalists haven't changed. They will play hardball if they feel threatened. But we have to begin to build the mass movements by which we save ourselves from a rapidly consolidating police state. The No Kings marches are great if it makes you feel good for an afternoon, but it isn't going to solve the problem. There has to be a direct confrontation with power, and we have to use our numbers and mass mobilization to cripple power and begin to hurt it. That's the only thing that's going to save us.
Well, you know, in that regard, the principal organizers of the No Kings marches perhaps have heard you, because some of those groups who planned the No Kings Day are now planning for a general strike on May 1st. I take it you think that might be a better idea then.
That's exactly the way we have to go. I mean, I was in Genoa and Rome with Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur on Palestine, who, by the way, the Trump administration has put on that, you know, the U.S. Treasury puts out its kind of terrorism list, so she can't use a credit card, she can't book a hotel room in her name, she's completely cut out of the financial system, as are the two judges on the International Criminal Court that issued arrest warrants for Yoav Gallant, the former defense minister of Israel, and Bibi Netanyahu. So we were there to support the dock workers in Italy who refused to load weapons onto ships bound for Israel. That's exactly the kind of stuff that we have to do if we're going to save this diminishing space within our open society. So yes, strikes are it. Mass strikes, I mean, most of the revolutions throughout history, there may have been an armed component to that revolution, but it was nationwide strikes. That was true in Cuba. It's true in Iran, by the way, to bring down the Shah. We have the ability, if we're organized, to shut the system down. We have to shut it down. We have to begin to shut it down before, you know, the Iron Gate closes. ICE is a very frightening organization. We've seen exactly, they're kind of our modern equivalent of the brown shirts, these detention centers that are being built all across the country. If you think those are for undocumented workers, you are extremely naive. That is how dictatorships work. They have rogue paramilitary units that essentially operate outside the law, outside any kind of control or accountability. We are really moving quickly towards that kind of a country. And the only thing that can stop it is if we can begin to inflict enough pain on the ruling apparatus to, if not halt it, at least slow it.
I understand that you just finished your book on Gaza. I want to ask you about that. And please talk to our audience about what the book is about, when it's going to be available.
Yeah, so I just finished a book with the cartoonist Joe Sacco, the author of Palestine and Footnotes in Gaza, which I think is one of the finest books on Palestine. We were in Egypt. We interviewed 29 families who had recently left Gaza to write the story of the genocide through their experiences. And that will come out in October. Fantagraphics is publishing that. But I think Gaza, you know, as I mentioned before, Michael, is going to be, when we write about the history of this period, a really important moment. Gaza essentially created the conditions by which modern genocide, you know, became acceptable again. And as we see in southern Lebanon, and as we are going to see as the climate breaks down, I mean, Israel will use the tools or the weapons that it produces to subjugate the Palestinians. They sell those weapons. They call them battle-tested, although that's not a fair term because they're tested on civilians, and you already see it showing up. So Israeli drones, the sensors, the ground sensors along the border with Mexico, this all comes from Israel, the wholesale surveillance. And as we are distracted from the Epstein files and from Gaza with the war in Iran, Gaza itself is, the Israelis have seized over half of Gaza, which is a tiny place. It's only about 5 or 7 miles wide and 21 miles long, and reduced people to living in utter misery without clean water, without adequate food, without any kind of medical support out in the open. 90% of Gaza has been destroyed. People are living next to fetid, open pools of raw sewage. Children are freezing and starving to death. And of course, this is just what they've done is slow walk the genocide and created conditions of such misery that eventually these people would be pushed out. And I don't expect anyone to intervene. I mean, that's, I think, what's so difficult for those of us, and I spent a lot of time in Gaza, 7 years covering Gaza, and have lost, like anyone who has spent time in Gaza, has lost a lot of people I care about. Interestingly enough, I mean, a few have gotten out, some are still alive, but a lot of them just disappeared. We would hear from them periodically, and then we just stopped hearing from them, and no doubt they're under the rubble. I think it's safe to say tens of thousands of uncounted dead, because only those Palestinians whose bodies were delivered to morgues or hospitals were actually registered as dead. And, you know, some estimates run in the hundreds of thousands. I certainly think that's very possible. I mean, the numbers that have been killed are far, far beyond the official figures. I think, what is it, about 70,000 or something. So that's what's been so disturbing, not just what's been visited on the Palestinians on Gaza, but what that means for the rest of the global south, for those climate refugees as the climate breaks down. I think the climate fortresses that are being built in the north have used Gaza as a kind of signal to say, we will stop at nothing. We will kill you en masse if we have to. That's the message of Gaza, and that is the message that the global south has heard and understands.
If you could tell us, Chris, there has been a lot of speculation when people talk about the midterms. Oh, there's speculation in polls taken as to how well the Democrats supposedly will do, to whatever extent that makes a difference. But there are also those who speculate on to whether or not, given some of the shenanigans that are going on, whether there will be midterms, or if there are indeed elections and the midterms, to what extent those elections could be called fair and democratic elections. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, I think Trump's threat to cancel the midterm elections has to be taken seriously. Remember, he tried to overturn the results of the 2020 election. He said he wouldn't accept the outcome of the 2024 election if he lost. He talks about serving a third term, defying the Constitution, of course, to do that. He's determined to retain absolute control, buttressed by this obsequious Republican majority in Congress, and he fears losing it. If he loses control of Congress, I think he fears impeachment. He fears, and this is more the people around him. I don't think he's very limited in terms of his intelligence, but the Project 2025 people around him do know what they're doing. They are intent upon reconfiguring America into an authoritarian state, and a loss in the midterms would potentially be a significant roadblock to that achievement. So I think we do have to ask ourselves whether, one, there will be free and fair elections, or two, even if those elections results will be honored by the Trump administration. Those are very, very, very real questions and very frightening questions, because if Trump and those around him are able to manipulate the midterm elections or essentially annul it, then I don't see any way out within the system, that there's no way out within the system at all to stop their project, which is coming very close to fruition, and which is the creation of an American dictatorship.
Well, Chris Hedges, this has been a very, very enlightening and important discussion that we've had. Do you have any final thoughts for our listeners?
Yes, I think time's running out. I don't think we have much time left. And I spent 20 years as a foreign correspondent and lived in all sorts of dictatorships, reported on them, whether it was Saddam Hussein's Iraq or Augusto Pinochet's Chile. So I've seen it. I know how it works. And of course, those who are attempting to build a dictatorship hide their goal until it is achieved. And then, of course, once it is achieved, it's too late. So I think those of us who care about an open society, care about democracy, care about freedom and civil liberty, really have to become very active very quickly. And as I said earlier, that has to be achieved by creating mass mobilizations that begin to disrupt the machinery that is being used to create this police state. People can find my work on chrishedges.substack.com. I also have a YouTube channel, and I put out columns, and I try weekly, although since both with the genocide in Iran, I tend to put out more than once a week. So that's been the focus of my work, certainly since October 7th. So chrishedges.substack.com.
Well, Chris Hedges, we thank you so much for your work, frankly, and for joining us here on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Thank you.